Okay, Genesis chapter 29. We're actually going to back up a little bit into chapter 28. And we looked at this last week. We saw how Isaac prayed that God would give the blessing of Abraham to Jacob. And sure enough, in chapter 28, God does give the blessing of Abraham to Jacob. But let's take a moment to look at Jacob's response. In verse 20, chapter 28, verse 20, it says, "Then Jacob took a vow, saying, 'If God will be with me, will guard me on this way that I am going, will give me bread to eat and clothes to wear, and I return in peace to my father's house, and Adonai will be a God to me, then this stone which I have set up as a pillar shall become a house of God, and whatever you will give me, I shall repeatedly tithe to you.'" Now, in 23 years of leading Beth Tikkun and teaching here, I've never done a tithing sermon. And I'm going to do one this morning either. But if I was to preach a tithing sermon, that's the passage I would use. There are other verses on tithing, but they get detailed and people say, "Was that really applied to today?" or whatever. But look what's happening here. Jacob has nothing to tithe. Unless he takes his staff and cuts a tenth of it off, the length. But he has nothing to tithe to God. He has nothing. But he says, "Father, after what you've shown me, after pouring out your love on me, establishing your covenant with me, Father, if you do these things that you promised me you'll do, and I have no doubt you will, but Father, I'll continually tithe to you from what you give to me." Now that makes a good tithing sermon. There's no commandment he's following here. It's just an outburst of joy in response to God. Most people, their faith does stop at their pocketbook. And, you know, do you love God enough to love him and to love your neighbor by using your resources? Do you love God enough to use your time? The rabbis say not only should we tithe a tenth of our finances, but a tenth of our time as well. That's, about 2.5 hours a day that you should be giving to the Lord. Do you do that? We should really take this seriously. You know, Jacob is in the process. He's starting the process of becoming Israel. Later on, down the road, he's going to be having a wrestling match, and his name is going to be changed. And I believe that for every believer, we are in the process of a Jacob becoming an Israel. For every one of us. And Jacob's started here. By making a vow to God. "You give to me, I'll give a tenth to you." Now, God doesn't need anything you have. After all, it came from him. He doesn't need it back. How do we tithe to him? We give it to one another. We get to the ministries that reach out to people. That bless us. That's how we do it. So anyways, if I were to do a tithing sermon, that would be the passage I would use, but I'm not going to do that, so I'm not. All right. Now, verse 22, interesting word there I want you to see. It's this word, Vaha'evan. Vaha'evan. You see that? And in English, it would be, "and the stone." That's the way Hebrew works. It takes several English words to translate a Hebrew word. Those last three letters right there, Aleph, Beit, Nun, are the word Evan, stone. The Vav, the first letter here, means and the second letter there means the, and the Evan, and the stone, Vaha Evan. Now, the reason I'm pointing that out, it's only found two places in the entire Bible, that word, of those five letters, only two places. Once is here, in this verse. The next place is just a couple verses away. It's in chapter 29, verse 2. Now, is that a coincidence? Is that an accident? Not at all. We know that every jot and tittle was hand-placed by God in his Torah. And we know that everything he does there is profitable for us. So what he's saying is that this stone that I had around my head while I was sleeping, and then I saw the vision in a dream of the ladder that was established in heaven and reached to the earth, and your messengers ascending, descending on it, and you're standing on top, and you speak to me these wonderful things. He had taken that and stood it up, and he had anointed it. And he called it Bethel, the house of God. And he says, "And if I return here, I will make the stone the house of God." And sure enough, that is the spot where the temple would later be built. So let's see where we find this word again. So chapter 29, verse 1. So Jacob lifted his feet and went. I like that. Lifted his feet. Didn't say he just went. He lifted his feet and went. No, sometimes you just have to use an act of will to make your body obey you. And you have to make your feet move. And they will obey you if you make them. Your body will do what you tell it to. Don't ever say, "I can't." He lifted his feet and he went toward the land of the Easterners, stepping out of Israel, the land of Canaan, for the very first time. He looked and behold, a well in the field. That was a fast trip. And behold, three flocks of sheep lay there beside it. For from that well they would water the flocks. Vaha'evan, over the mouth of the well, was large. There's the word, the same word, only two times it's found in the Bible, right there. What do you think God's trying to teach us? One of the things you're going to see is that everything Jacob touches comes alive. It brings life. It's almost like magic. You've heard the Midas touch, everything King Midas touched turned to gold. It turned out to be a curse instead of a blessing. Everything Jacob touches brings life. Abraham and Sarah just could not have kids. And finally, when he's 100 years old and she's 90, they finally have a baby together. Isaac marries Rebekah. They just couldn't have kids. So he prays on her behalf. And we don't know how many years that took. And finally, she has twins, Jacob and Esau. Jacob, he never has to pray for his wives to be fertile. Now, Rachel had some hard time, but you're going to see in a moment, Leah has four children. And then Rachel's handmaid has two. Then Leah goes back and has two more. Then her handmaid has a couple. And then Rachel finally has a couple kids, 12 boys. We don't know how many daughters. We know at least one, but we know there were more than that. I mean, it's just he'd look at one of his wives, and 9 months later, there'd be a baby. So everything he touches turned to life. So here he is. He comes to this well. It's the same well that Eliezer, Abraham's servant, visited years earlier to find a bride for Isaac. And here now Jacob, the offspring of that union, is at the same well. He's going to meet his bride. But something happens in between. Let's see what happens. Verse 3, when all the flocks would be assembled there, they would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep. Then they would put back the stone over the mouth of the well in its place. Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where are you from?" They said, "We are from Haran," or Haran, as your Bibles might say. He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know." Then he said to them, "Is it well with him?" They answered, "It is well. And see, his daughter Rachel is coming with a flock." So now there's a fourth flock joining them. Then Jacob asked a question. Rachel hasn't got it close enough to where Jacob got a real good look at her yet. But as she's approaching the well, he says to these guys, these shepherds, he said, "Look, the day is still long. It is not yet time to bring the livestock in. Water the flock and go on to grazing." But they said, "We will be unable to until all the flocks will have been gathered, and they will roll the stone off the mouth of the well. We will then water the flock." In other words, when finally everyone's gathered together, then finally we'll get relief. I'd heard that my whole life growing up in church, and it is true. Finally, a day is coming, we'll all be gathered together and we'll all have relief from this life here. But Jacob's now in town. He says he doesn't have relief right now. So what does he do? Well, you know, like Popeye gets the spinach, he gets strong. He took one look at Rachel and he was just bursting with strength. He says while he was still speaking with them, Rachel had arrived with her father's flock, for she was a shepherdess. And it was when Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the flock of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came forward, rolled the stone off the mouth of the well, and watered the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel. This is the only place in the Bible you see a man kissing a woman. And he raised his voice and wept. Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. So back to the stone. What's the significance here? The first time we see this word Vaha'evan, it's a stone that Jacob has set up as a memorial stone for what God has spoken to him there, the vow he's taking to God, and looking to the future where this will be the place where God and man meets. The temple will be built in this place. And that's all wonderful and good. But how does that help you and help me? You see, the second place we see the word Vaha'evan and the stone, Jacob's pushing it away from the well so that life can come forth to water the sheep and the shepherds. In other words, connect these two together. If you want to establish God's temple on earth, you want to establish his presence on earth, then bring life to your neighbor. Find the thirsty and give them water. If you want a memorial stone that proclaims God's glory, then do good deeds to your neighbor. What did Yeshua do when he came to earth? He went about doing good. See, we always say, well, I want to go do ministry. All right, then go about doing good. Do good works. Be filled with good works. Sometimes we tend to grow up thinking good works are that's what religious people do. I'm going to be spiritual. No, ministry is what religious people do. Doing good works that genuinely help your neighbor, that's what spiritual people do. Everything we touch, we should try to bring life into that thing. When we speak a word to someone, let it be a word of encouragement, something that gives life, that brings truth and light to them. And when we help people, let's help them practically. Let's not do like James said. Someone comes into your presence and they're hungry and they're thirsty and they need clothing. You say, oh, be blessed. I'm going to pray for you. I'm going to call the prayer chain right now on your behalf. No, give them some food. Give them clothing. Give them shelter. Help them out. You see, that's the truly spiritual thing to do. So if you want to establish God's presence here, you want your life to be memorial, start rolling stones off of wells. Help people in practical ways. You understand? This isn't rocket science, okay? Okay. Any signs of life out there? Any signs of life? Just do something. All right, there we go. Good. By the way, the interesting thing here is that word for watering, you find it several places where he watered the flock. It's Vayashek. It's spelled like this, Vav, Yud, Shin, Kof. But then in verse 11, it says, Vayishak Yaakov l'Rachel, and he kissed Rachel. Same word. They come from two different roots, but just so happens the way they're used here, they're spelled exactly the same. That's not a coincidence. Now, someone reading this and just learning Hebrew might think, that must have been one wet, sloppy kiss he gave that girl. Because he watered her, you know. But the reason I believe God put that word there is, you see, Rachel, her name means ewe, E-W-E, a female sheep. She comes with the flock. And there's a picture being painted here. Jacob's like Yeshua who has come and he's bringing life. He's rolling the rock off the well like he did with a woman at the well in John 4. He helped her dig out the well of her heart and living waters came out of it. And here's Jacob providing water to the sheep, but he waters the ewe, Rachel, his bride-to-be as well. You understand? And so there's a neat connection being made there that you can only see in the Hebrew. Well, let's go on and see what happens next. She runs off to tell her father Laban. And Laban must have thought, oh man, I remember last time somebody came from Abraham's family. They had 10 camels filled with riches and clothing and fruit and great food. I can't wait to see what this guy's brought. He runs down, there's Jacob. He has nothing but a staff in his hand. Verse 13, and it was when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, he ran toward him, embraced him, kissed him, and took him to his house. He recounted to Laban all these events. Then Laban said to him, nevertheless, It's like funny. Nevertheless, why is that there? It's like, well, even though you don't have 10 camels loaded with loot, you're still bone in my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with them a month's time. Then Laban said to Jacob, just because you are my relative, should you serve me for nothing? Tell me, what are your wages? Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were tender, while Rachel was beautiful of form and beautiful of appearance. Now, Rachel, what's Rachel's firstborn son going to be named chapters later? What's her son's name? Joseph. When we read about Joseph, and he got sold to Potiphar, it describes Joseph. And you know what it says? He was beautiful of form and beautiful of appearance. He took after his mom. He was good looking and he was in good shape. Verse 18, Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, I will work for you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than I give her to another man. Remain with me. So Jacob worked 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him a few days because of his love for her. Jacob said to Laban, deliver my wife, for my term is fulfilled, and I will consort with her. It's time for our wedding. So Laban gathered all the people of the place and made a feast. And it was in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him, and he consorted with her. Imagine this. Rachel is planning her wedding. This is how I see it, and I think the Hebrew supports this. She's planning her wedding. 7 years they've been basically engaged, and her wedding night has come, and they've got all the food, the invitations, the friends, the feast, everything else. And when it's time for her to go into her tent so that Jacob can come to her, Laban says, no, not you. Your sister's going to be in your tent to welcome Jacob. And it's dark in that tent. It's not till morning Jacob realizes what has happened. How would you feel if you were Rachel? Laban is a dirty, low-down scoundrel. That's all I can say about him. He really is. His name, Laban, means white, but when you reverse, it becomes Nabal, fool. And he's very foolish in what he does. So, anyways, he has the feast. There's the wedding. Jacob goes in. Verse 24, and Laban gave her Zilpah, his maidservant, a maidservant to Leah's daughter. And it was in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. So he said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel I work for you? Can you imagine how ticked he would be? Why have you deceived me? Laban said, such is not done in our place to give the younger before the firstborn. He doesn't say the elder. He says, the firstborn. He uses the feminine term, Bechira. Remember we talked about the firstborn last couple weeks ago? Who does the firstborn status normally go to? The Bechor status? To the firstborn son. But what did Jacob do? He went in, deceived his father, and got the firstborn status for himself. Now look what has happened to him. Listen, folks. God had promised the blessing and the firstborn status of Jacob. And if he had waited, it would have been given to him in God's own way, in God's own time. Whenever you try to help God out to hurry things up, it always backfires. But here's the principle. You never get away with anything. Ever. Don't ever think for a moment you ever got away with anything. There may be a delay between the deed and the consequence. But the consequence is still right there square in your path, and you're going to smack right into it eventually. Sometimes sooner, sometimes later. But there's no avoiding the consequence. God has ordained that for this world. So let's make sure you understand something. You never get away with anything. I finally saw a church sign I really liked. It says, there's no right way to do the wrong thing. And so, Whenever you try to get a little extra change from the cashier, or they give you the wrong change, you think, oh man, I made out on that one. Oh, no, you didn't. You'll have a fender bender or something else is going to take that change you thought you got and a lot more with it. It just happens every time. It just happens. Those are the consequences of sin. You don't get away with anything. God will forgive you, but the consequences are still there. So have I said that enough to where you're going to remember it now? Okay? Because I know God doesn't keep teaching me that one too. And I see a hand up finally. If you're visiting, you're welcome to ask questions and share comments. So my lovely bride has her hand up. Oh, no, you need a microphone. People complain if they don't get to hear what you say. All right.
Do you think the same is true if you flip it for every
good thing?
Made for good.
Absolutely. Good.
And it may not be experienced immediately, but it is in your path. I think it's important to mention.
Thank you. Yes. See, that's what I love about this girl. She brings balance. Yes, every good thing you do, you may... It may feel like it turned out sour. No, every good deed has a good consequence. Just be patient. All right? Every single thing that you do, even the words you speak in private, will be proclaimed from the housetops. Sometimes we tend to think that's just the bad things I say. No, it's the good things you say, the good things, the prayers you prayed, the words of encouragement you said in private, the notes you sent to someone to encourage them. That's going to be proclaimed to the world. The rabbis say we create worlds with every good deed we do. And we destroy worlds with every bad one. That's a very heavy thought. Well, let me ask you a question here. Where have you seen this before? A guy comes to a well and finds a bride. Where did we find this story before already once? The story of... Eliezer and Rebekah, yes, Jacob's mother. Eliezer was sent by Abraham. Says, I don't want you taking a bride. I don't want my son marrying one of these local girls. I want you to go back to my hometown where Sarah came from and I came from. And I want you to find a bride for my son Isaac. So Eliezer, this faithful servant, He loads up the camels of all these good things that Abraham had, a representative of all his wealth. And he goes, he comes to this very same location, this very same well. And people are watering their flocks and he prays, Lord, let it be that the young lady who comes here and I ask her for a drink of water, that not only will she give me a drink of water, but you'll volunteer to water my camels as well. Lo and behold, here comes a shepherdess, Rebekah. He asks for water. She gives him water and says, let me water your camels as well. Now, these two stories we must put side by side because they form a what? A menorah pattern, right? So let's just compare this a little bit quickly. Rebekah. When she came, Eliezer didn't water her flocks. She watered his camels, which is a much bigger job. So she exerted great effort for Eliezer. But when it came to Rachel, Jacob exerted great effort on behalf of her. He rolled the stone away from the well. Everybody with me? Okay. With Rebekah, she was recognized after her actions. She gives him water. She waters the flock. She does everything just as he prayed God would have a girl to perform as a sign. Then he says, who are you? What's your name? Who are your family? And then she tells him. But what with Rachel, he doesn't even ask, what's that girl's name? He's asking, is Laban living in this town? Is he doing? Oh, yeah. Oh, by the way, there's his daughter Rachel coming right now with the sheep. He has her name before anything happens. It's exactly the opposite. Rebekah watered Eliezer's 10 camels, but Jacob watered the one flock. He watered Rachel's flock. At least that's what's stated. He might have watered the others, but it specifically states he watered her flock. Now, when it came to Rebekah, and Eliezer came to Laban's home, and before they even ate, he says, I have to tell you what I'm here for. I'm looking for a wife for my master Isaac. And I would like Rebekah to be that woman. So they call her in. And they ask her, Rebecca, you want to go with this guy and marry Isaac, his master? They ask her. But Rachel's never consulted for her opinion. You want to marry this guy? All right? Rebecca operated by faith. In other words, do I really want to go with this guy? Is Isaac fat? Is he skinny? Is he short? Or is he unnaturally tall? Is he ugly? Does he have teeth? Does he have hair? Is he smart? Is he going to love me? Is he going to treat me well? I don't know this man. But she went by faith to marry somebody she'd never met. She only heard Eliezer's word for things. I'm sure she must have asked a lot of questions. But we have one question she asked. When they finally approach close to Isaac's, the land where Isaac lived, she says, who's that man in the field? And he says, that's my master, Isaac. And then she veils herself. And then she goes into Sarah's tent. They're married. But anyways, she operated completely by faith. But for Rachel, Jacob worked. It's not faith there. Jacob worked for 7 years for Rachel. She saw this guy. She saw him every day. She saw him working. She knew what he looked like. She knew him. Now, back with Rebecca, Eliezer gave gifts and food. Jacob gives only himself. He has nothing to give but his own labor. He has only himself to give and nothing else. He gives 7 years of his hardest work for this bride. And then Rebecca, of course, enters Sarah's tent with Isaac. But Jacob, he enters Rachel's tent and finds Leah in the morning, is who he's been with. Is there any coincidence that these things are like exact opposites? They happen at the same location for the same purpose, for a descendant of Abraham to get a bride. But they're just opposite. Can you think of some others we could put on the list? I mean, one obvious one with Rebecca. Abraham sends a representative, Eliezer. But when it comes to Rachel, Jacob himself, the husband, the man seeking the bride, comes himself. He doesn't send an intermediary. What are some others you can think of? Can you? Yes, Steve, just shout it out real loud and I'll repeat it.
Moshe.
Pardon me?
Moshe.
Moshe. Oh, yes, there are other wells where men... Oh, no. Differences between the Rebecca and Rachel, the two stories of Rebecca and Rachel. By the way, the Rebecca story is back in chapter 24, if you want to go back and check how that all pans out. Any others you can think of off the top of your head? There are plenty of others. Yes, Brian.
Eliezer prays beforehand.
He does. Good. There's prayer involved here. And then he praises God immediately after he gets the right answer. Now, did Jacob pray or not? He did. He prayed back at the end of chapter 28. He prayed at the end of chapter 28 before he even starts the journey. Okay? So there's prayer in both cases, but one is before the journey. And with Eliezer, it was after the journey was completed. Okay, good point. Any others? Yeah, Joe.
The criteria for Rebecca's is more spiritual.
Yeah.
And Rachel's more physical.
Yes. Joe said that with Rebecca, it was more spiritual. She showed her qualities by giving the man, the stranger, some water, and then just volunteering to water the camels. We're not told one thing about what she looked like. With Rachel, she must have been a knockout, because when Jacob finally got a good close look at her, he was smitten, he was inspired, he rolled that rock off the well, then grabbed her up and planted a big one right on her, you know? So, yeah, it's just complete opposites there. Good point. We're going to bring that one up a little bit later. Any others? So let's take one more. Adam.
I guess Rebecca was brought as a wife, whereas Rachel was
Yes. Jacob came to her, and with Rebekah, she went to Isaac. Good point. Yes. She was brought to him. And then I saw a hand up back in the back. Was it Phil or Dan? Phil? Oh, same thing. Okay. Yes, Deborah. They both had two sons. That's true. But that's a little later on. That's a later on part of the story. But yeah, there's no question. They both had two sons. Yes. All right. Well, let's move on a little bit. Let me ask you a question now. This is not too hard. I think you'll all figure this one out. What I want you to do is take the story of Rebekah. That's the one over here on the left, the one that happened back in chapter 24 with Eliezer coming to find a bride for Isaac. Now, just strip away the historical detail, so to speak. And just ask yourself, where have we seen this before? Where a call goes to a person to leave their father's house, to leave their family, to leave their land, to go to a place they've never been before and do it completely on faith.
Abraham,
absolutely. With Rebekah, we see a person like Abraham. What a perfect match for Abraham's son Isaac. One who has the faith of Isaac's father. He marries a woman with the same faith that dad has. You understand? It's the same spirit. But with Rachel, everything's different. In the Rebekah story, everything's about Rebekah. But in the Rachel story, everything's about Jacob. His actions, his work, his suffering, his deception. So you know what I think these two stories are showing? I title this, Rebekah and Rachel, Faith in Two Directions. Rebekah, to me, is a picture of what our faith should be like. But the Rachel story is a picture of God's faithfulness to us. In both cases, there's a bride. But with Rebekah, we see the glory and the beauty and the character of the bride. But with Jacob, in the Rachel story, we're seeing the qualities and characteristics of the bridegroom. And who's he? He's our Messiah. These two stories take place at the same location, but the focuses are different. So you see, this is why you put them together. We look at Rebekah, and that's what we should be like. We look at Rachel and Jacob, and we get a picture of who Messiah is and what he is like. Make sense? Okay. Let's talk about menorah patterns. I'm always using the term. So let's go ahead and discuss a little bit about why they are so important, why I put so much emphasis on them. Yeah, that looks better, doesn't it? In the tabernacle, you had the outer court. That's this area we'd see all the people walking around. But inside this building here, you've got two compartments. You've got the holy place, and it goes about to there. And then in the back, you've got this cube-shaped area, the Holy of Holies. The sun, moon, and stars provided the light for everything out here in this area. But God's glory provided the light for everything in the Holy of Holies. Here in the holy place, the light was provided by the menorah. What you're looking at, when you look at the tabernacle, is a picture of many different things, but one of the things it pictures is you and me. We have an outer court called the body. We have a holy of holies called the spirit. And the thing that connects the two is the holy place. And in the holy place, your soul, the part of your soul where everything happens, is in the brain. In the brain. And the menorah is a symbol for your brain. Your brain, scientists say now, you don't have a brain. You've got two. How do you like that? You have two. You know what you always ask, somebody else says, oh, they've really got brains. Why do they always say plural? Why don't they just say he's got brain? I think we almost know intuitively that there are two. There's a left side and a right side, and they work completely independently of one another. And it's on the left side of the brain that we process speech and language. But it's on the right side that we process context. You have some people who just take everything so literally. They can't ever see the context for something. That means they're very left-brained. Because the left is the what? The left is the physical. And the right is the spiritual. And you're going to find that everything that takes place on the right side of the brain has more of a spiritual component to it. On the left side of the brain is where we process math and calculations. But on the right, art and music. At least melody. It's where we process melody. Rhythm and harmony is all on the left side of the brain. But the melody, the beauty of the music is on the right. And we can go on and on and on with this. But you're going to see that your two brains connect. And what's that thing that connects them? The medulla oblongata. That's where they come together. And we have found that autistic children, the one side and the other side, don't communicate as they should. And Robin's done a lot of study in this and worked with autistic children for years. And there are actually places now that can take a child through exercises. It's very, very painful emotionally. But if they can go through it and endure, the two sides of the brain begin to build the connections. The autism, at least the symptoms of autism, begin to diminish in very, very markedly measurable ways. It's amazing what has happened. And Dale, you don't have a microphone back there, do you? Okay, just shout it out. I'll repeat it. If it's short. Oh, here comes a microphone.
The heart is part of considered the brain. Yeah. You probably know where I'm
sure,
going.
Yes.
And my question is about love. We process love, feelings and emotions and all kinds of things that we call love or we define as love. They're processed in the brain. But what's the connection? What would you say, maybe like me, yeah. I don't know, is this a right side experience? Is this a left side experience?
Oh, love? Well, love definitely emanates from the right side of the brain. But the affection and the physical, the touch, the smile, the connection is from the left side. But yeah, absolutely. In fact, the word love is Aleph Hey, Beit Hey. The two sides even look alike. They both end with the letter Hey. But everything about God's word, everything about the fruit of the Spirit and so on, connects the physical and the spiritual. And everything, I want to think about that love question more. But I'm going to move on right now because otherwise my brain will get spinning and we'll never get on with the teaching. But that's a great question. Really is a great question. What Dale was also referring to, the heart. We talk about the heart. Well, then, in Jewish understanding, the heart is really the mind. It really is the mind. And the spirit doesn't dwell in your heart. It dwells in your brain. It dwells in your heart, in your mind, I should say. It's always thought of as dwelling here. It really is true. But reason I'm going on to these menorah patterns is this. The menorah was the source of illumination inside the tabernacle. And what that means is that the source of light is something that's very balanced. And for every left branch, there's a right branch. They're always in balance, so it sits squarely on its bottom. But there's always a center stem, and there's this balance. Because that is how God provided light for the tabernacle. That's how he provides light in your soul. There are always truths that seem to be opposed to each other, but when you bring them into tension and into balance, they provide double the light. Even the constructs of the menorah itself. Who made the menorah, God or man? Man did. Physical. Where did the plan for the menorah come from? God. You see? The spiritual came from the right, came from God, and the physical, the construction, came from man cooperating. Everything that God wants revealed through his word is always on the pattern of the menorah. Even the Bible, you've got a Hebrew section on one side, and you've got a Greek section on the other. Who came in between? Yeshua. He's the Word made flesh. He connects the Hebrew and the Greek scriptures. And you make a profound error when you put aside the Old Testament, because I'm a New Testament Christian. You know, there's no such thing without the Old Testament. Or people just say, well, I just embrace the Hebrew scriptures, I throw out the New Testament. Profound error. Because everything the Hebrew scriptures point to is found over here in the New. But if we have a proper understanding of who Yeshua is, they come together. They make a perfect marriage. They make a menorah. You know, the first verse of the Bible is seven words. The first three are Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. That's spiritual. We can put that over here. These three words are spiritual. Three words. The last three words of the verse are Hashemayim ve'et ha'aretz, the heavens and the earth. That's physical. And by heavens, it's referring to the skies. So that's three words. Well, what's that fourth word right here in the middle? It's the word et. It's not even translated. It's made of aleph and tav, the first and last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Who's that? Who's the aleph and tav? The alpha and omega, the A and the Z. Who is that? Yeshua. The very first verse of the Bible is a menorah. And as you go through the scriptures, you will find everything, and I mean everything, that God wants to teach us will come in this pattern. There will be things that seem opposed, but somehow similar, and we find them and can put them together. They will point us to the middle, we'll know what holds it all together, and we will get a clear picture of who our Messiah is if we do that. And our brains will just light up. It's wonderful. You'll see the physical, you'll read the words on the scriptures, but then there's a spiritual component comes along and says, I understand what this is saying about you, Father. And it draws you closer to Messiah. You know, when you use your brain and you see something, that's a menorah pattern. Your eyes see something physical there. They see a tree. Well, how do you know that's a tree? Because the other side of your brain comes along and interprets what you're seeing and tells you what that is and calls up the volume of material and information you have about that tree and experiences you had with trees, falling out of them or eating from them or cutting them down, making things out of them. There's all this wealth that comes, but your eyes see just physically a tree. But there's this unseen spiritual part of you. It's conjured up by what you experience. Do you ever just smell something that you hadn't smelled since you were a child? Maybe a kind of candy or something. All of a sudden, you're back in first grade, you know, and remember when you tasted that for the first time or how that was your favorite candy back when you were a kid. The physical, spiritual, always happening. The external, the internal, always happening together in balance. Over and over and over. This is why I can't avoid talking about menorah patterns. To not talk about menorah patterns means I just have to quit teaching the word altogether. Because they are everywhere in the word of God. Everywhere. Everywhere there's light in the word, you're going to find the menorah pattern if you look for it. It's there. What happens if you have half a menorah? What happens to it? It's going to fall over. You got to. So many people's theology, they work so hard propping up their theology because their theology is not balanced. When it's balanced, they can step back and go, ah, that's better. I don't have to struggle and strain trying to hold up what I think I believe. Well, let's go on. Let's start looking at Jacob's children. So it says in verse 28, so Jacob did... verse 27, complete the week of this one, Leah, because they have a week honeymoon, and we will give you the other one too. So you can have the other one, you have them back to back. But you have to work another 7 years after you get Rachel. for the work which you will perform for me yet another 7 years. Verse 28. So Jacob did so, and he completed the week for her, and he gave him Rachel, his daughter, to him as a wife. And Laban gave Rachel, his daughter, Bilhah, his maidservant, to her as a maidservant. He consorted also with Rachel and loved Rachel more than Leah, and he worked for him yet another 7 years. Adonai saw that Leah was hated. Now, I don't think it was the person that Jacob hated. I think it was the whole thought, how this all happened. I wanted one wife, that one. I got two, including that one. I'll never forget the pain attached to waking up in the morning and finding out it was the wrong sister that was given to me. I'll never forget the pain and the hatred for Laban I experienced when I saw how he deceived me. And every time I'm with Rachel, I'm thinking of the honeymoon we missed that went completely off the rails. And Leah, this unwanted wife, she's the one who experienced my first burst of love. And after a week with her, Rachel gets the leftovers. Everything about Leah was a reminder of everything gone wrong. And then Jacob had to be thinking, what I did, the way I went about getting the blessing and the firstborn status from my brother, and how I deceived my father, probably wasn't the right way to go about it. It was a source of pain, constant source of pain. But Jacob was a good man. Everything he touches comes to life, even Leah. So it says in verse 31, Adonai saw that Leah was unloved. That's how a merciful translation puts it. Hated is more literal. So he opened her womb, but Rachel remained barren. Leah conceived and bore a son. She called his name Reuben. Reuven, from the word Ra'ah. Ra'ah means to see. And so he's called Reuven, which means see, a son, a ben, a son. So she conceived and bore a son, named him Reuben, for she said, because Adonai has seen, Ra'ah, my affliction. Surely now my husband will love me. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, because Adonai has heard, that's the word Shema. Shema, Yisrael, okay, it says the word Shema, that I am unloved. He has therefore given me this son also, so she named him Shimon. See, the first three letters of Simeon, or Shimon, as it should be pronounced, are the same as the word for hear. She named him Shimon, hearing. She conceived again and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will become attached to me. Now the word for attached is the word lava, to hook together. Because I have borne him three sons, therefore he was named Levi, hooked, or at least hooked to me. Levi, connected to me. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, this time I will praise Adonai. Therefore she named him Judah. The word Odah is the word that's used there. And that is the root of the word Yehuda, Judah. Okay? Now, look at the cry of Leah's heart. See if you can see a progression here. This time, instead of looking at the sons and their names, look what she says about her husband each time. When Reuben was born, she said, surely now my husband will love me. Then Simeon's born. She says, Adonai has heard that I am unloved. Then she gives birth to Levi, and she says, this time my husband will become attached to me. I'm not expecting love, but unless he'll feel an attachment because we have parented three children together. But when Judah comes, husband's not even mentioned. This time I'll just praise God. The love she had hoped to find in her husband, she finally transferred and realized, I have that love from God. And so many times we're looking for love from a particular source. And God says, eventually, Maybe. You have to first come to your primary source. That's me. And when you begin to realize how much I love you, then we can talk about changing other people. You have to realize I am the one. And I think that as this went on, Leah began to love God more. And I think as she began to love God more, she cared less whether her husband loved her or not. But you know what? I think that by the end, Jacob came to love her. And if you go to Jacob's tomb in Hebron today, in Israel, who's buried next to her, Rachel or Leah? Leah. Rachel's buried in Bethlehem, miles away. Not too far, but several miles away. But Leah is the one who shares the tomb with Jacob. Half the tribes of Israel, six of them, came through Leah, the unloved wife. Which leads us to another menorah pattern. Let's compare Leah and Rachel. Leah, the name means weary, tired, worn out. Rachel is a female sheep. Now, it says Leah had tender eyes. We have no idea really what that means. Was she weak-eyed? She squint all the time? One pretty authoritative commentary, rabbinic commentary, says her eyes were blue, which to us would be very attractive. But in the Middle East, blue eyes are like, who wants blue eyes? This thick, you know, rich, dark brown eyes, that's what's beautiful. But blue looks weak. Okay? Brown is earthy and solid. Blue, that's up there. That's just the air. Weak eyes. So that's a possibility. Could have been that Leah truly was beautiful to most people in the world, but in the Middle East, she was not considered beautiful. That's just a possibility. She gives birth to six sons and at least one daughter that we know of, Dinah or Dinah. Rachel, though, she was beautiful of face and form, and she has two sons. And I put down here that Leah was the wife of Israel, Rachel was the wife of Jacob. This is just my own reading into it. You know, Jacob becomes Israel. But it was Jacob who saw Rachel and just fell for her. But I have this feeling, and you can agree with me or not as we continue to go through the chapters in the future, that by the time he became Israel, his name has changed, he really began to love Leah. But we'll see. We'll see. Now, Leah, her fourth son is Judah. And Judah becomes the tribe through whom all the kings come. But Rachel, her son, her firstborn son, is Joseph. And I love the story of Joseph. I know many of you do too, as we get to it in just a few more chapters. Joseph becomes the savior of the world, of the known world at that time. He's hated by his brothers, sold for silver, goes to the Gentiles, that he arises, becomes the leader of Egypt, takes a Gentile bride, and then during 7 years of terrible tribulation, his brothers, his Jewish brothers, come to him. He recognizes them. They don't recognize him. And to them, he's making life really rough for them, but everything is to bring them to a place of reunion. And finally, on that magic day, he puts everyone else out of the house. He calls his brothers around him. He has all 11 of his brothers. And he says those words, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. And they just can't believe it. Everything about Joseph is a picture of Yeshua. And what was Yeshua's adopted father's name? Joseph. So he was known as Yeshua ben Yosef, Yeshua, son of Joseph. And everything about Joseph is about Yeshua's first coming. Everything about Judah, and we think of David, the king of Israel, who descended from Judah. And Joseph, or Yeshua, physically descended from Judah. When we think of Judah, we think of the physical king. We think of his return. This is his first coming. This is his second. Now in Genesis, towards the end, over in chapter, was about 48, 49, Jacob blesses his 12 sons. And he says, the scepter will not depart from Judah. But then he has this hidden prophecy inside the Hebrew where he says that Joseph will be the one who's crowned among his brothers. Now, what does a king have? Two things. He has a crown and he has a scepter. The scepter is like a club. This represents him enforcing his law. But the crown is something that gives him a symbol that I am the king. This is my authority. This is my big stick. But we know when Solomon died, his two sons split the kingdom into Israel and into Judah. So later, God sends the prophet Ezekiel. In chapter 37, the word of Adonai came again to me, saying, "And you, son of man, take for yourself one stick and write on it for Judah and for the sons of Israel's companions. Then take another stick and write on it Joseph." But see what we're doing here? Joseph, the son of Rachel. Judah, the son of Leah. Two different wives. Two different programs. One has the scepter, one has the crown. And he says, "For Joseph, the stick of Ephraim and all the house of Israel, his companions. Then join them for yourself one to another into one stick, that they may become one in your hand. When the sons of your people speak to you, saying, 'Will you not declare to us what you mean by these?' Say to them, 'Thus says my master, Adonai, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim and the tribes of Israel as companions, and I will put them with it with the stick of Judah and make them one stick, and they'll be one in my hand.'" Now, we know this is a prophecy of how the two kingdoms of Israel, of Ephraim, son of Joseph in the north, and Judah in the south, will be reunited. But there's a deeper one. It's saying the Messiah who came at first, that the Gentiles all recognize. Remember, Joseph had a Gentile bride. And then the Messiah who will return as the King of Israel to drive out the enemies and establish his throne forever. He's got the Jewish bride. David's wives were Jewish. He's really, they're one. It's one Messiah coming at two different times. They're one. In my hand, they're one. What you see is two sticks, they're really one. Isn't that amazing? Kind of looks like a menorah, doesn't it? Just saying. And our time is gone. Should we take a vote as these guys can share some comments? I want to hear what they are, but I don't want to hold us over too long. What do you say? Those of you who are awake, should we let them speak? Okay. All right. We'll start with Jim. Since you have the microphone right there, go right ahead.
Was there any written significance of the daughter born during the time of the sun?
Oh, we will get to that. Yes, the significance of the daughter. It tells us that Jacob had daughters, plural, but we're only given the name of one, of Leah's daughter, Dinah. And she plays a big role later on, about chapter 34, if I'm not mistaken. So we'll get to that in a few more chapters. So hold that thought. And then over here to Adam.
Just the verses you just went over, I personally find them to be an encouraging prophecy. And I'm sure looking at it from the messianic perspective, others might as well. Just the idea that there's times when as a Gentile believer, it's easy to look at the stick, you know, of Judah and say, "I'm not a part of that." But then when we look at ourselves, not as an independent stick, not, you know, just that stick of Ephraim, but when we look at the hand holding on, we recognize that we are being made as one.
Absolutely.
That is in the process of being fulfilled.
Well put. So true. So very true. Thank you. And Phil, we'll give you the last word.
You know,
well, that's perfect. Good.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was really amazing is looking at Tom Rader and his role in Jacob's life. You know, he robbed the birthright of Esau. And so God uses Laban to teach him probably one of the most critical lessons in his life, you know, about, you know, let him do the work and not do it yourself.
Yeah.
And we see what happens when, you know, he works for his wife, and then he doesn't get the wife that he wanted, and then he pays a horrible consequence, you know, in what happened. Imagine that night as you described. And it makes me makes me think how critical it is that God uses Laban to teach him in extreme discomfort.
Yeah.
You can imagine the emotion and everything that he went through to make him change over time.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And God brings a discomfort to him that we can't even imagine. This
oh, yeah.
That he
very
has
well.
Deal with. So it's like he's prepping him for the future to become Israel.
Yes.
You know, and so
exactly right.
It comes to that point in that day where God uses a very untrustworthy man, you know, to do all these things to him, to start adjusting him at that time, to weed out what is not good to him, to where he comes to a point where he is going to wrestle with God.
That's right.
And it's amazing.
It is.
And the application in our own lives, you know, where we get people in our life that drive us crazy.
We all have a Laban.
Yeah,
we
and,
do.
And they come and it's uncomfortable, it tortures us, but we, in the big picture, we realize those things are there in our life to change us because we will not change sitting on a couch.
Right. Laban's cheating of Jacob made Jacob twice as fruitful. Where would he be without the six sons he had through Leah?
Right.
We'd be talking about the four tribes of Israel or maybe the six tribes of Israel, but not the 12. So Laban's cheating of Jacob, giving him the wrong wife, well, it turns out it wasn't the wife Jacob wanted, but it was the one God wanted him to have. And I think Jacob had to have realized that later on. Had to have realized that. He was too smart not to.
Yeah. It's all the Father.
It's all him.
Yeah,
he is so sovereign.
Even those horribly uncomfortable moments in our life, it's there for a reason.
It is. It's so true. Amen. And our time is truly gone now. I still see some hands up, so just start raising them earlier next week, Steve. All right? So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for the wonder of your word, these amazing truths that are right there, hidden in plain sight. And Father, I pray you'd help us to think in a more balanced way, to read your word in a balanced way, to live our lives with greater balance, so that we will walk in the Spirit and make the flesh our servant to accomplish your purposes in this world. Make us the people, I pray, that you want us to be. We ask in Yeshua's precious name and for the sake of your kingdom. Amen.